listening to the Artist First World Radio Network, artistfirst.com. Tony K in the studio. Thanks, audience, for joining us worldwide. All broadcasts available free on demand 24/7. Be sure to share our content with everyone you know on your social network sites. Thousands of hours available free on demand at artistfirst.com. Enjoy them. And this hour on Authors First, it's my great privilege to introduce a fascinating guest. You may have heard her in the past on Artist First Radio. She's a creative, talented writer in magazine, television, books. She covers multiple genres of material. If you enjoy adult sci-fi miniseries, she's all over the map, a great writer, and this time with a new book in the crime element, a true story, and here to tell us about this latest project. Audience, it's Barbara Casey. How you doing, Barbara?
Hi, Tony. I'm fine. How are you?
Wow. We love having you on. Thank you for supporting the arts. As I mentioned, audience, you'll find, I believe, two or three other interviews with our guest. You just have a plethora of thought and projects. You love research and reading. You've been involved in book promotion. I don't know where to begin with you, Barbara. You're just a great resource for authors who have a great idea to write a book. You're an agent, an editor. What else? Screenplay writer, Barbara Casey, Casey. Just do a Google. You'll find so much, audience, on our guest. Or simply follow the link provided at artistfirst.com to go directly to barbaracaseyagency.com. You'll reach the right person if you do that, all right? But Barbara, you have a fascinating story to tell us about some recent research that led to your latest book. And ultimately, you ended up with Ron Chepcik of Strategic Media Books. And of course, Ron Chepcik has his show here at artistfirst.com, Crime Beat. Those who love true crime stories, love learning about them, and hearing directly from those who, in many cases, perpetrated the crime. Crime Beat, fascinating show with Ron Chepcik. And Barbara, you have delved now into this area of the criminal mind, and thank you for joining us. Tell us about the backdrop that led you to this book.
Well, prior to this, all of my writing has been fiction, novels, mostly for adults. A few for young adults, but when I was doing some research for a book that I'm working on, I came across Catherine Kelly, and she was the wife of Machine Gun Kelly, and I found tons of information about Machine Gun Kelly, but very little about her, and every time I kept coming across a little tidbit of information about her, I just became fascinated about this woman. She was so unusual. Of course, it was back in the days of the Prohibition and gangsters. And anyway, I started digging into her background and eventually wrote a book, her story. And that's my latest book now. It was just released, and it's called Catherine Kelly, The Mall Behind Machine Gun Kelly.
Wow. Now, were they then partners in crime, or...?
She was basically the brains behind everything that he did. He had, up until he met her, just been a petty criminal. He had done a lot of bootlegging. He went into bank robberies, and which isn't a petty crime at all, but he just wasn't very good at what he did. And he always had partners to help him. And then when he met Catherine, she motivated him. She wanted the grand lifestyle. And in order to live that grand lifestyle in the days of the Depression, they needed to have a lot of money. And she was the one that was really behind the ideas of what they would do. She would... For their bank robbery, she would dress up like a man and drive the getaway car, and she loved the excitement of it.
Well, with a name like Catherine Kelly, a little Irish there?
On his side, his name was George Barnes, and he later took the name Kelly, just as trying to change his identity and trying to change his whole persona. Catherine was born Cleo and Lyra, and she didn't think that was glamorous enough, so when she was 14 years old, she dropped out of school and changed her name to Catherine. She thought that was more suitable to what to her goal in life, what she wanted to be in life. So she had this plan, long-term plan, but it just involved a lot of crime to succeed.
Well, we often practice what we see. You know, I was just trying to probe to understand, did she come out of a ghetto situation, or did he, there's Little Italy, there's Little Greece, there's Little Ireland. You know what I mean? That the,
right.
The immigrants at that time of history were still very much gang-oriented and living in pockets where, you know, families would all come from the same country, same town, and live in the same neighborhood.
Well, actually, in their case, they were very Midwestern. He came from a well-to-do family. His father was in the insurance business, had a nice, thriving company. But Catherine came from a rural background. Her mother was didn't work except maybe working as a clerk in a store occasionally, and her stepfather was a farmer for all practical purposes and a bootlegger. So she learned bootlegging early on, and as I said, she dropped out of school when she was 14 and got married, and then from that marriage, she had one child, a daughter. It didn't last long. She remarried a couple of years later. That didn't last. She married a third time, and his name was Charlie Thorne. And she was accused of killing him. It's a fascinating story. She had gone to visit her parents and heard while she was away that her Charlie was seeing another woman. So she drove back to her home, stopping along the way to fill up with gas, and she told the gas station attendant that she was going to kill that Charlie Thorne. And when she got there, he wound up dead somehow. She was accused of the murder, but then later on, they discovered a typewritten suicide note. But what they didn't realize, Charlie Thorne was illiterate. He couldn't read or write, let alone type. And in the suicide note, he was explaining why he was putting an end to it all, and he used the word hence, a word that no one had ever heard him use before, so it was suspicious at best, but she got away with it. It was later rumored that she probably was a friend of the coroner, and that was how she got away with it. But then after Charlie Thorne, that was when she met George Machine Gun.
Wow, a mastermind, a criminal mind.
Yeah.
And beginning rather early, marriage at 14,
right.
And then moving, you know, into murder and ultimately bank robbery. And in the 30s, they gained such notoriety that they were known nationally, right?
Oh, yes. And they all knew one another, whether they knew one another personally or they worked together on different jobs, or they just knew each other by reputation. Now, in Catherine's case, her mother and stepfather actually rented out rooms. They had a ranch, and they rented out rooms to these gangsters who were on the run, and that was a way that they would supplement their income. So she was around the criminal element from a very early age, but she enjoyed it. That was the thing. I kept finding out about her. She really enjoyed the thrill of it.
Machine Gun Kelly, he must have enjoyed the notoriety himself. I mean, weren't those the days of hanging out the car window and shooting up the windows and there's the film guy, right? I mean,
yeah.
You know, trying to capture it.
Right.
Black and white, obviously, no color.
Yeah.
There weren't TVs in everyone's home. So these became reels that of shot that would be shown in the movie theater, right? You'd go in it.
And, you know, you have to remember back in those days, no one had anything. And so when they saw these gangsters getting away with all these crimes, they almost became folk heroes. The people enjoyed seeing stepping outside of their own lives and visualizing these other things, even though they were criminal activities. People enjoyed knowing about it and reading about it.
Yeah, there was this fascination, almost like Robin Hood, right?
Yes.
Robbing from those mean bankers that stole all of our money during the last Depression.
Right.
You know, good, they're getting their comeuppance, you know?
Well,
and then the bootlegging, right?
Bootlegging was such a big thing back then, and it was just an easy way to make money, which was the bottom line. They were just trying to survive. And, of course, Machine Gun Kelly, he was constantly going in and out of prison, and usually on bootlegging charges or bank robbery. And at some point, when he and Catherine got married, they decided that bank robbery really wasn't what they wanted to do any longer, because it was becoming too dangerous, for one thing. Banks were getting smart, and they were hiring guards, and they were afraid they were going to get killed if they kept robbing banks. And not only that, a lot of the banks didn't have that much money anyway, because everybody had taken their money out. And so that was when they decided they wanted to go into kidnapping. That would be easy. They could identify a target, hide their target, demand a huge amount of money, and then release the target, and nobody would get hurt, or so they thought. So that's what they went into.
Yeah. Now, ultimately, she never had children, right?
She had the one daughter
first
marriage.
Okay, the one daughter.
Right.
And what happened to the daughter? Were you able to find out anything about her life or the direction of her life since her mother chose a life of crime?
It was an amazing story in its own right. Catherine, when she became involved with George Barnes Kelly, she left her daughter with her mother and stepfather to raise with their children. And so she was free. She wanted to be free to do whatever she wanted to do with George Kelly. And it was years later, after Catherine had gone to prison, and of course by then her daughter, Pauline, was just a young teenager, and she had enough sense to know that she wanted to be educated, and she had taken what little bit the court had awarded her from her mother's possessions to pay for what she could for higher education. She wanted to get her degree. And when that money ran out, she started approaching the judge who had been in charge of the whole trial, asking him to turn over her mother's furs and jewels and that kind of thing so she could sell them, because she wanted to complete her education. Well, that didn't happen. But eventually, Judge Voigt contacted her and said he had arranged for her to continue her education. And it was years later, after the judge died, that they were going through his personal papers, and they came across a sealed envelope. And in that envelope was a handwritten note from one of the kidnapping victims that he had paid for Pauline's education. But he did it anonymously. He didn't want anyone to ever know that he had done that. But it was quite a story. She went on and became a teacher, and she got married and had two children of her own.
Wow. What a story. Award-winning Barbara Casey joining us on Authors First with an incredible book, True Crime Biography. And you know, when you look at the number of books out there that cover women in the criminal world, it's a short list.
It is.
And you have really done some research that has been neglected. Now, she was in prison for
25 years.
And then out in when? What year did she was she released?
58.
And then did she live much longer after that? Or
she died in 1985.
Oh, my. Okay. So she lived another three decades after getting out of prison.
Yes, Mandy, I have a question.
I imagine,
on March the 27th, which is
with her daughter, grandchildren,
Easter Sunday,
or,
you guys open?
To have some sort of a normal life, huh?
Oh. Okay. I would like to make reservations for 11:30.
Transformation for Catherine.
It's going to be seven of us.
She has been such a vivacious, exciting, and an attractive woman because... And she used all of that.
Yeah, between 11:15 and 11:30, it's okay.
Wanted. She was always getting out of predicaments, not going to jail because she didn't look to get what she wanted. And then
the name is Casey.
She was sentenced. She and her mother were sentenced to life in prison, and they were released 25 years later.
And okay, that's my last name.
Out,
Al Casey.
A completely different
and then Casey.
Person.
That's my
It wasn't that. Yeah, I don't think she was. Mm-hmm. Maybe there was some deceit
there.
It's
561.
But she didn't want to have anything to do with any
7064.
She didn't want to be around anyone. She just wanted to live a quiet life with her mother. And
okay, that's fine. Thank you.
Bye-bye. She did have some contact with her daughter and then, of course, her grandchildren. But I'm not sure that it was that much. I think one of the grandchildren helped her in the very last years after Catherine's mother had died, but there wasn't that much contact. If there's one redeeming feature about Catherine, it was the fact that she really did adore her mother, and the main trial was when she and George kidnapped a man named Charles Urschel, and he was a wealthy Oklahoma oil man, and that was what did them in, because J. Edgar Hoover was just determined he was going to make a statement by capturing them and just throwing the book at them, which he did.
And Machine Gun Kelly himself.
Yeah.
Served and then went on to do what?
Well, Machine Gun Kelly also got sentenced to life in prison. He went to a different prison, and so he and Catherine never saw each other again after the trial. He was nicknamed Pop Gun Kelly in prison because he was no more of a Machine Gun Kelly type than anyone, but Catherine had built up that image of him and that reputation because that was what she wanted. There was the story of how she bought him his first machine gun and gave it to him. And they would go out to her mother's ranch, and she would make him practice shooting against the barn or whatever. And then she would collect all those spent empty shells and then pass them out as souvenirs at the speakeasies and the bars and all the places that they like to frequent. And all the time just spreading the stories about her big bad man. So she was behind that whole image of Machine Gun Kelly. And then when he got to prison, he was Pop Gun Kelly because he wasn't that type of person at all. He died in prison on his 59th birthday, and so he never did see Catherine again.
amazing story, and the amount of information that you were able to uncover of a personal nature, those who had made acquaintance or writing or newspaper articles and so forth, there was actually some footage, things that you could access to have a portrait of what they were like in real life.
Yes, in fact, because there was just so little about her that I really had to dig primarily into the FBI vault. They had all the court records, and then, of course, the newspapers of the day. There were several newspapers around the country that were covering the full story, and I was able to access those. And then, strangely enough, when Catherine was in prison, she decided to write her own biography, and she called it The History of My Checkered Career, and the name she put with it was Mrs. Catherine Machine Gun Kelly Barnes. So she was really proud of that association, the Machine Gun Kelly Association. But she wrote a sort of autobiography, trying to explain her feelings and the reasons for why she did the things she did.
And people have their own, of course, motivations for doing that, right?
Yes.
They want people to see the world tinted through their own eyes.
And that's right. And their backgrounds and their own personal experiences, what motivates them. And in her case, she just wanted more than what the farm life offered her. She couldn't wait. I think that was probably why she married so young the first time. She just wanted out. And, of course, she was a child herself, and then she had a child. So it makes you wonder if she had been given the opportunity, would she further her education. Or she was a bright woman, and how she could have used her intelligence and creativity. But she chose to go criminal way and not in a more positive way.
Yes. I mean, and that can be said of male or female, of every generation, even today. You know, you wonder why people choose to get involved deeply into drugs or illegal prostitution or whatever the vice might be, you know.
And even if they're offered another opportunity, they still choose not to accept the other opportunity. I know I was talking to someone recently about a bank robber, and he served his time and supposedly is rehabilitated, isn't robbing banks anymore, but yet every time he goes into a bank, he immediately starts searching out where the cameras are, where the guards are, just casing it. It's just built into his DNA. He can't help himself.
And that is as true of all of them, I think, when you get right down to it. You know,
right.
It's a fixation they can't just conquer. You know, if you know how to open a safe, you know how to light a fire, there are so many things that the human mind and body derive satisfaction, pleasure, or an attempt to fill some deep, dark unknown, you know, that's buried there.
That's right.
That they want to fill that cavity that's empty, and this does it, you know, this exhilarating activity. BarbaraCaseyAgency.com. Listeners, that's the link for our guest this hour, Barbara Casey, and her incredible new book. You're going to love it. It's getting high reviews, available all over the World Wide Web, and I think you can order it also directly from BarbaraCaseyAgency.com. Is that right?
Or the publisher, Strategic Media Books.
Yes.
Or Amazon or Barnes & Noble. It's available pretty much everywhere.
Well, hey, let's tell them all to go to Ron Chepsik's Strategic Media Books, because if they like true crime biography books, not only will they find you, but they're going to find a massive library covering topics and criminal activities of our recent history, too, you know, that are often neglected.
That's right.
So I love the work that Ron Chepcik is doing and his affiliation with Artists First Radio, and he's just phenomenal out there. I forget how many books Ron has written himself. It's got to be well over 30, maybe 40. So he's prolific and involved in screen, television, movies, a busy, busy guy, and we're blessed that we have him here to help us understand a little bit about the backdrop of the criminal mind and what how people get involved, you know.
That's right.
You know, sometimes they're born into the circumstance, and other times they get into it through someone they meet incidentally, secondhand, you know. And so they come to their activity from different angles, and it's just fascinating. And if you look at television today with cable, how many shows are there now? You know, you got Mob, you got Mob Wives, you got...
And the police shows, you know, it's just a lot of criminal activity type shows. People are fascinated by it.
They are, you know, and we want to know, we want to understand. And then how we find these people ultimately and bring them to some form of justice, you know, if that's possible. Because I think in many cases there is no good justice for the criminal for the crimes they've committed, you know.
No.
When it's murder and rape and kidnapping and the vallus of crimes, you know, that's different than petty theft.
Well, in Catherine's case, she tried to become an informant. Once they were captured, and she wanted so much to get her mother released, and herself included. She wanted to be released as well, but especially her mother, and she offered to turn informant because she felt like she
knew enough. Wow, that'd be exciting, you know, I can get out of prison, I can
right.
go undercover.
Exactly,
you know?
And she did. She knew so many of the other criminals and gangsters, and she knew their hideouts, and they were staying at her mother's ranch, you know, and so she did have information, but J. Edgar Hoover wouldn't have anything to do with it. He wanted her put away, and also there was one of the friends of Charles Urschel was very important in politics and wealthy in his own right, and he had J. Edgar Hoover's ear as well, and he just insisted that she not be released. So there was a lot of that. The way they got Charles Urschel's name was Catherine was reading the society pages, and she was trying to they had tried kidnapping a couple of times, and it was a disaster. Machine Gun Kelly drove one poor man around Indiana for 2 days trying to convince him to pay a ransom. And the man didn't have the money, so he finally just let him out. And then another poor guy, he talked to Machine Gun Kelly into letting him go home, and he would get the money and send it to him. So they let him go, and of course, he never sent Machine Gun Kelly any money. So Catherine was determined that she was going to find a good victim, and she read about it in the society pages that this Charles Urschel had married a wealthy widow. Her late husband was also in the oil business, and that's how they picked him. And they went to the house one night, and Charles Urschel and his wife were playing bridge with some friends, and George Kelly didn't know what Charles Urschel looked like, so he took both men and drove around, and then finally went through their wallets and discovered which one was Charles Urschel, let the other man go.
Now, she wasn't totally creative, right? Because during that period of time in the paper, there was another big incident going on, right? Lindbergh.
Oh, yes. Well, that had happened, right, just around that time, a few years earlier.
A few years earlier. Yes. So here's a hypothesis. Hey, you know, boy, somebody kidnapped, you know, Lindbergh's baby for rent, for money, right?
Yes.
Hey, there's an idea. And,
right.
And sort of that's kind of a win-win for her, because this brings her attempt to do this at the same level of the Lindbergh kidnapping.
That's right, because Charles Urschel was well known, and they were demanding the $200,000 ransom, which was unheard of back then. That was the largest ransom that had ever been asked for. And
So once again, that's a media thing, right?
Yeah.
Hey, you know, it's the biggest amount.
Right,
it's a kidnapping.
Right.
Is this a Lindbergh repeat? You know, she's trying to get her visibility in the papers, the media, you know, and other people's attention, I would imagine.
That's right. And J. Edgar Hoover even started the story that Catherine and George might have been involved in the Lindbergh kidnapping. And they tried really hard to connect it, but they never did find any connection. Although it did come out later that Catherine and George did know about the kidnapping, and they did know who had been responsible and how the baby had died. So they were close enough to it to know, had to have that information, but Hoover wasn't able to ever tie the actual kidnapping to them.
Now, they were actually ultimately apprehended, brought to trial, and then to prison in Oklahoma, right?
Yes, where because that was where the kidnapping had taken place and all, and so that was where they were tried. There were two trials. They couldn't capture Catherine and George. So they had one trial with everybody else that was involved, her mother and stepfather, stepbrother, uncles, another partner. Everyone that had anything at all to do with the kidnapping were in one trial, and it lasted 12 days. And in the meantime, the FBI and all the police, everybody that was available was looking for George and Catherine, and they were just driving all over the country. They were running out of money. And again, we go back to where people were looking at them like the Robin Hood syndrome, because they were giving them their cars to use and giving them money, just protecting them. But eventually, they just the FBI was too good. They tracked them down.
Yes, and of course, as a woman going to prison for these charges, she ended up in West Virginia.
That's right. And
that's a female prison there,
it's
right?
It's sort of a minimum security, yeah. She wasn't always there. She started out several rough prisons. But that was where she and her mother wound up, and they shared a cottage there. Both of them worked on the prison grounds. They both worked in the flower shop for a while, and then Catherine, again, she was smart. She worked as a secretary in the garment shop there on the campus, the prison campus. That's also the same prison where Martha Stewart served her time for that insider trading a few years ago. Camp Cupcake, that's where.
Wow. Now, did you travel? I mean, you were able to reach out to George Kelly's son, relatives, other associates in your research, and photographs and so forth of Kathleen Kelly, and that is a task in and of itself. Did you actually travel to these locations? Were you able to find things on microfiche or the computer? I'm sure it was most helpful.
Right. A lot of it done on computer, corresponding with people and of course by phone, emails. Again, the FBI vaults are just wonderful, because in this case, even though they didn't have a computer back then, everything, so much of it was handwritten.
Yeah,
it was really a struggle to get through thousands and thousands of records.
And they were interviewing other people that would have known them or seen them or heard them say things, you know, in certain locations. And that really helped you flesh out a lot of missing details.
A lot of the detail, and just to get a feeling for the atmosphere and the dynamics of the trial itself. In fact, it was the first time that they allowed a camera with sound in a courtroom during the proceedings. So there was that. I got the actual film with the sound of that trial, and so there are things that are out there, but it took a lot of looking, a lot of search.
Yeah, I mean, you know, the book Kidnapping Charles Urschel, that sounds interesting.
I know, because
the plan, the plot, the area, why, the whole thinking behind it,
it must have
been difficult for you amassing all of this information to try to stay focused on your topic.
Well, but it was so fascinating. And every time I'd come across just a little piece of information, especially about Catherine, because I was trying to flesh her character out. I wanted to get to know her. And at one point, I discovered that she owned a Pekingese dog, and Sam Wee. It was Sam Wee, and so she called it Sammy. And I thought, gee, you know, this woman has a heart. She loves dogs. So I just.
Oh, yeah, well, hey, you know, of course, Tony Kaye, he loves dogs, and Barbara Casey loves dogs. I know that. BarbaraCaseyAgency.com, audience. That's the link where you want to go for this important book. And lots and lots of other great reasons, because Barbara, you are an incredible writer, beautiful human being, a great contributor to the arts. Thank you for your leadership on so many levels of getting others motivated to become writers and representing them through the maze of the literary world to become a published writer, and then all of the marketing required afterward. Congratulations and thank you for your participation with Authors First, and for coming back again to be tortured and tormented by Tony Kaye on this radio show. That'll be a true crime biography for a later date.
Thank you so much, Tony.
But what fun you're having. I imagine in this process, we've already talked a little bit about the enthusiasm that it generates when you, that act of discovery. What was that the most fun part of this process?
I think so. And then actually fleshing her out, actually getting to know her, because I feel like that's one thing my book does. It really does introduce you to the real Catherine. I just loved the research. I was surprised. I thought that it was going to be so difficult that it would be overwhelming, but I really enjoyed doing that, and I'm looking forward to writing my next nonfiction true crime. In fact, I've already started researching it, but I enjoy, it's like you enjoy the search or the destination or the traveling to get to the destination, but that's where the joy comes.
Well, Barbara, we're going to dig deep right now, and I know that somewhere in that massive clothing closet of yours, you have the hat and the clothes of the era and the shoes, and I hope those very uncomfortable hose or stockings they wore. And you've actually dressed in character. Tell me that it's happened.
It has not.
Oh, geez, come on. At this hour, we really wanted to know. But there was a lot involved to be a woman in public, to look good for a camera. There were standards that women had in that period. Did you get it a little in character that way? And
I could identify with them. I really could. I could understand where they were coming from because it was on trial. She was there primping for the cameras and giving interviews and flashing smiles. And she just, her clothing was beautiful. She was beautiful. She just had no idea that she was going to be convicted. She really, it just caught her. She just didn't think that it would ever happen because she'd always gotten away with everything before.
Well, you know, you got to think. Now, here's Machine Gun Kelly. He's already had a reputation, spent some time in prison. He's known through Tennessee and Mississippi as a bootlegger, you know, because it's prohibition. You know, that's kind of a wild, crazy, running from the law, shotguns in the car,
right.
Doing your dirty deeds at night, working at the speakeasies, where there's illegal gambling, things that the government would frown on, right? And yet she's drawn to that lifestyle.
Right.
She says, wow, here's this guy. He's got an exciting, he's a bootlegger, you know? And so there's...
And a bank robber. He had just finished robbing a bank around the time she met him. So he had a wad of cash.
Why don't you close it for me?
And he was a nice looking man. So he had a big smile and she fell for it. She thought, this is the man I want to.
Yeah, I'm going to escape the farm, and I'm going to have some.
Right.
I'm going to live the life, okay? Yeah.
And that's what they did for 3 years. And I'm sure it was exciting. But, you know, it's just another.
Well, who doesn't want to be the star, right? I mean, if you go to the theater back then, they were glamorizing.
That's what they were doing.
Type of
Bonnie and Clyde.
Yeah.
They were there at the same time.
That's right. See, so if you're 14, 15, 16 years old, and you see this going on in the theater, and you're bored with your life, and you have a brain between your ears, and some good-looking guy comes along, and he's already in the life of glamour, you know, you just think you're living a movie.
That's it. And it worked for them for a while. I think in her autobiography, there's a section in there where she talks about when she has her daughter and how that gave her so much happiness, but it was just fleeting because the baby hadn't even turned one yet, and Catherine started having these longings again for the excitement, the life of crime. So she just was needed that adrenaline rush that she could only get through criminal activity.
Yeah, and so fortunately she had someone that the baby could go to.
That's right.
And so she did.
And that turned out well.
Well, what a life, what a story, and what an amount of work. Now, you came up with the idea when we started the broadcast. How much time did it take to really delve this deeply into this character to where you could say, hey, I'm writing a book of fact. You know, I'm not going to make it up. I'm not going to fill in gaps. I'm going to really stay loyal to her character and the events surrounding her life.
I really, I think one of the nicest compliments I have received so far was someone told me that it was such a good nonfiction book because it read like a novel. And her story is like fiction. It's hard to imagine, but I didn't have to embellish. I just told her story, and I mean, the facts are there, and the incidents and the situations. The one interesting thing too is Charles Urschel had photographic memory, and that was in the end. That was how the FBI found out who had kidnapped him, because even though he was blindfolded and bound on the floorboard of the back seat of the car, it was at night, but he could hear things, and he memorized every bump, he heard oil wells pumping and how many and how they were spaced. When they finally got him to the location where they were hiding him, he could hear the animals, the farm animals. He knew how many cows and how many chickens, and I mean, he just memorize everything.
They just didn't know how smart a person they were nabbing, right? I mean, could you imagine? I will just, you know, blindfold them, throw them in the trunk, you know, they'll never know a thing. And here it's tic-tac. I can count the number of rotations your wheels are making and how many miles we traveled and what we passed. I heard the cow moo, you know. Wow. And that was ultimately their undoing because he could recollect such detail. And that's why I jokingly said earlier, you know, you could have wrote the book about him, the kidnapping.
I know. Fascinating man.
Yeah, and how that all went down. And, you know, there are always two sides of the story. And then, you know, it's obviously a terrorism. There's nothing funny or joyful or cute about kidnapping. And the families, the police, the media, you know, it just stirs everybody up, right?
It does. And yet there were elements to the whole story you just had to laugh. It was just funny. For example, when they finally released Charles Urschel, they let him out, I don't know, a mile or so from home. He had to get his own way home. They gave him a cab fare. And they gave him a brand new shirt and a straw hat. The shirt was like a Hawaiian shirt. He shows up, it's in the middle of the night, he shows up and the FBI won't let him in his own house because they don't recognize him. Of course, he doesn't have any identification or anything. And so he goes around the back door, he knows where the key's hidden, and he lets himself in and eventually convinces the FBI that he's Charles Urschel. But, I mean, things like that are... It's sad and it's frightening to think that if you had to go through it, but yet it's funny. And when the men took Charles Urschel, where they were taking him to the hideout place, George Barnes, he forgot to fill the car up with gas, so they ran out of gas. It rained hard, so they got stuck in a mud puddle. He had to get out and push. They got lost, so they had to stop and ask for directions. I mean, it was just a comedy of errors, this guy. And the whole time, Catherine's waiting, you know, to get the big ransom money. She's going to have a ball with that.
Well, fuel's a nickel, but, you know, your car only gets 3 miles to the gallon, you know? And so you're right, you know, that in that period of time, if you went out too far from civilization, there were no gas stations.
There weren't
routes going coast to coast of major highways anywhere. They were dirt roads. Cow paths, and that's the way it was in the 30s and the early 40s.
And of course, they were driving from Oklahoma to Texas, to Paradise, Texas, which is where they took him. And so I guess they did get lost.
Yeah, I mean, no GPS or cell phones. Like, you know, there was no help. Pull out the map. Where are we? Well, somewhere in this county, you know. It's like, are we going north, south, east, or west? Look at the stars, you know. I mean, that's how primitive things really were back then. And what a world to study in a period of time. Thank you for sharing what went into creating this wonderful book. And Barbara Casey, agency.com, the website, audience, Strategic Media Books, buy 10 right away. You're going to love the book and love giving it to other people who enjoy this topic by a fabulous writer. Barbara Casey, thanks for joining us this hour. Before I let you go, anyone out there on planet Earth you'd like to say hello to, or closing remarks for our listeners?
No, I just want to thank you, Tony. I always enjoy visiting with you, and thank you for having me again. I've had such a good time.
I know. We're so lucky, aren't we? And we can do it again, so feel free to come back on your next project, Barbara, and give our best to our good friend Ron Chepsik of Crime Beat. We always love his broadcast, so check him out later on, audience. Thanks, Barbara.
Thank you.